It's now time to think outside the box of what we've always known.
I myself will tend my sheep and have them lie down, declares the sovereign Lord.
I think that's a profound turning point in somebody's relationship with God.
And our hope in starting this was that this would become an ever-expanding conversation.
Just two real guys talking about life. That's a nice tagline.
Well, I'm Wayne Jacobson.
And I'm Brad Cummings.
And welcome to another edition of The God Journey. I got an email from somebody after the Easter weekend.
You did?
And they spent some time with, I think it was some fifth graders or five-year-olds. I don't remember what, some Sunday school.
Fifth graders or five-year-olds. That's a little bit of a span.
Yeah, and they said that what was interesting about the day is half the kids thought Jesus was crucified at Golgotha, and the other half thought it was in Gotham City.
The dark night of the soul is really Batman.
I just love that. It's either in Golgotha or Gotham City.
Yeah, the dark night. That's it. Yeah.
That is funny. I had a good chuckle.
Lucifer is the Riddler.
Yeah, really?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I felt like it.
He's creepy, isn't he? That's pretty creepy. I don't know that I want to go there. Ugh. I'm off to Indiana and going to do finally this teaching on the scriptures and called the Jesus Lens.
The Jesus Lens, you got one.
I don't know that I have one. But
you know how to look through one.
I'm just so concerned at how many people give up on the scriptures when they begin a journey of love. The religious interpretation of scriptures is so strong in their head. As many of them said to me, I can't even read the Bible without being condemned.
See, I'll be honest, I don't get that.
No, I don't either. So I'm going to help people. I've been wanting to do, I get in this discussion all the time on the road, and it's kind of like the transitional kind of transitions. I'm going to do this on video, which I'm just going to tax me to no end.
Get a haircut.
Really? You don't like it?
Just poking at you.
I figured. I've started my Grecian formula, though, so no.
Oh, sweet.
I know.
Sweet. The wet look.
No, it's actually going to be, I'm not looking forward to videotaping it. I wish we were just audio taping it, but so many people have asked for a video. No, it's not that part of it. It's just everything you add to a room destroys a conversation, even if you add a recorder to it. Now you add cameras and lights to it.
No, just look into the lens and speak to the guy on the sofa. Tell him to reach out his hands and put them
And send me $1,000.
No, don't go there.
Hold it.
Reach out and... You know.
See, that's what I'm afraid of. I'm afraid those lights do that to you, because everybody does it. So I'm thinking they'd all go in there You think they go in there intending to do that stuff?
You know, no, I don't. I used to anchor the news. And
so if they don't go in there intending to do that stuff, it might be the lights or the camera. All of a sudden it makes you go, can you send me $1,000? And then you go, ha ba 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 ba.
Maybe that the lights are too hot and you get a little fried in your brain. I don't know.
Or maybe the hell thing comes in.
But you know what's cool about that? If you can get past that.
I hope to. I'll let you know when I get back.
No, it facilitates a further conversation.
No, that part, yeah.
And I think if you can focus on that,
that's
the beauty of all this technology stuff. It's like, you know what? It's just a tool.
It is that.
It can help people who are not physically there. And it's different, but the truth is you can recognize that. What I love about what we're doing is this furthers a whole conversation that, you know what, it'd never be possible otherwise.
Sure.
I love that.
I'm gonna see if I love that.
I'll be praying for you, though.
A lot of email of late and blog postings and whatnot. People like Leroy's story, and a lot of people added to poor Leroy, the disjointed dog.
The dog whisperer?
I like this from Ken. No, he's not the dog whisperer. He's in need of one. Ken wrote this, Leroy wants to be loved, but Leroy also wants to be free. And what Leroy has learned is every time someone reaches out a loving hand to him, it's to put a chain or a fence around him. So he keeps his distance. He'll gladly be loved, fed, and cared for, but Leroy wants to be free. So he keeps his 20 paces and runs when anyone gets close. Of course, Leroy is still trapped. He's bound inside an invisible fence of his own making. But at least he draws his own boundaries. He is the gatekeeper. That gives him some sense of comfort. He is in control, but he isn't free. The prison of fear is indeed locked from the inside, and the person inside alone holds the key. That's a neat observation, I think.
Yeah.
It really is. I just...
You know what's cool about the whole bit of real freedom? It's not found in my having a sense of control. Because I think I've learned enough. I've gotten wise enough to go, I don't want to be in control. I don't have enough mastery of anything to say, gee, I want to control this. It's the fact that I do trust I'm not alone and that there is someone greater than I who is active and engaged in my life. But I don't even need God to be in control of everything because, I'll be honest, I don't think he is. There's other human beings out here that make decisions, that do stuff that sometimes is not helpful.
I think we spend 20 years teaching people that you can be in control of your life. You can work hard and, you know, have your dream and be president of the United States or win American Idol or whatever it is that you want. We spend 20 years teaching people that the possibilities are limitless and you alone control your own fate. And then it takes the next 60 years for you to realize,
I don't want to be in control.
No, now you don't want to be. You aren't. No one is. You never have been. I mean, to me, control is just an illusion. You think you're in control until you run into other people who think they're in control, and then it all kind of breaks down after that. And I like the idea that control is just an illusion.
Yeah.
I don't have it. I don't need God, like you said, to fix everything in my life either. I just want him to go with me through whatever it is that we're going through.
I don't even think it's a safe place when it's like, well, God's in control of everything. And it's kind of like, really? Because I end up with some really wigged out, funky conclusions if I accept that as the first premise. Because then there's a lot of really bad things that I can't ascribe in any way, shape, or form to God and his character that he then is the author of. And I'm going like, I don't think so.
Yeah. Derek wrote this, and I think partly the Leroy thing, but also the kind of coming from the whole Calvinist, Slap a Calvinist for Christ podcast. Which was unfortunate in many ways. I'm really struggling with a life lived loved where my family, church, and entire community never showed me love. I realize now that this is a result of the Dutch Calvinist beliefs, the work hard and then you die model of religion. Work hard and then you die. And welcome to this world. And we have the temerity to call this the gospel. Anyway, God's been gradually freeing me, and I've been running with him as fast as I can away from all that, but I still realize that I can't quite grasp that God in reality, in three-dimensional space on this earth, actually loves me. I'm not that old. I'm 25, and thankfully God is not allowing me to be in that situation anymore. But there is a lot of damage from it. I was really hoping you guys could do a show on people like me and others who have lived lives without love, but with examples of how God has broken through all that and transformed their lives. Any thoughts about that? I know we've talked about this in times past.
Yeah, I'll be honest, I don't know that this is necessarily going to be helpful, but I struggle with the fundamental premise that says I've not had any love. I think a lot of times our lens through which we interpret it, we sometimes narrowly out of our own pain and hurt squeeze that down, and that so unless someone loves me in my preferred language, I assume no one loves me. And there's tons of people around me trying in ways that is germane to them, but maybe is not what really connects with me. And I don't think that is, I don't think it's true that no one and no love has been shown. And I don't want to be unkind to someone who's hurting.
It's a good thing because people will write us.
Yeah, I know. No, that's always, I love those emails.
Thank you very much.
It's one anyways. But I think the reality is, it starts from perhaps dropping the shields of that conclusion and asking the question that says, Lord, help me see what I've missed. How I didn't feel it the first go around. What did I miss? Where are you? Because I don't know how to do anything other than start with a question of, hey, God, help. I need some different revelation than what I have.
Yeah, and if you take the premise that no one in fact has, and I've actually met people where I would say that's probably true. They didn't have parents that cared about them. Most friendships they had betrayed them at some point. And I think I know people like that. But what you have missed, here's the important deal, is that you have a father who's been loving you. And you might have missed that, particularly if you were growing up in a Calvinist kind of environment. You're probably definitely going to miss that. But how does God win that in the lives of people who have no love meter? I mean, they just don't know how to detect it when it's coming. Because even, you know, poor Leroy, he's out there and somebody's trying to feed him and wants to pet him. And his alert deal is so up that every hand extended is a threat. even if it's not. It's perceived as a threat.
No, I understand.
And I do think it often, unfortunately, there's just no easy answer to say, well, this is the way that that happens. I can say it does happen for people, and it's more an intuitive knowing that begins to rise from within than it is a practical external, here's four steps to get there.
See, I think it can be something as simple that I think is helpful as, quote, unlocking the door. Out of fear and out of pain, we lock that door, we shut it, and we protect ourselves. And it's going to take an awful lot of courage to unlock that door. But I think sometimes that's really all it is unlocking it for the possibility of something else. And then in the humility of heart saying, God, help me. Show me. Connect with me in some way. I don't think you can convince yourself.
Yep.
I don't think it's just, well, you know, pray this prayer, brother, or, you know, repeat this thought several times, or just look at the sun and realize it's for you. I mean, I don't think that's what it is. But I do think that we can, in our pain, in our own unforgiveness of, I've just been too hurt, we can close off and we can turn off our receptors. And I don't know what turns those back on, because I don't think God forces himself into that moment.
Yeah, I don't think he forces it, but I do think people around, and to me, this is what living loved and loving others means, is that if someone's first taste of the love and faithfulness of God comes through the way I treat them over time. And we've had people in our lives like that, neighbors that were crusty, arrogant, angry. And just because Sarah and I took an interest in them and loved them over time, there was an ability for them to not treat everybody with anger, fear, and suspicion.
Yeah.
So I do hope on the other side, if you're inside that and you feel like no one has ever loved you, well, God has. And if you've missed that, nobody's going to blame you. It's not you're a creepy person. It's just... You know, start over. Like you said, unlock a door. Just say, God, I want you to reveal your love to me. But I want to say to people outside of that, look for opportunities to love like that. Find people in your life. And they're not usually, if they don't know how to be loved, I mean, Leroy, you know, not an easy dog to love at the moment, because he's not going to give you anything but walk behind you 25 feet. But if you open your life and just are there and show people what love is and not use people for your own gain and toss them aside when you're done with it. I think there's a way to learn to love people around you in a way that helps them unlock that door. It gives them more of that courage to go, okay, well, maybe if this person does it, maybe it isn't me. Because I think the internal blame on people like this often is, I didn't get love from my parents because I didn't deserve it. I didn't get love from people at my school because I didn't. I'm a mess, or what? I think that whole self-pity, shame-based thing really does take people under at that point.
And I think that's the horrible impact of unkindness, is that the person that gets wounded by it, unfortunately, almost turns on themselves when they're looking to find the answer as to why. And I'm like, I don't know why people are unkind. I know hurt people, but why do they hurt me? I don't know.
Because they hurt people.
You know, it's like, I don't know how to answer that in a one-to-one correlation, because I'm just like, I don't think a one-to-one correlation works on this planet all the time. There's stuff that happens like, I didn't do anything that invited that.
Oh, absolutely. I think that, we live in a broken world where self rules the day, and you're in my way, I'm going to walk right over you to get what I want. That's more common than people who will lay down their lives to serve and help.
And I do think that, for me, there's been some real freedom that just kind of says, you know what, I don't have an answer for that. Why is that person? I mean, I've watched people that just have this incessant need to define and control and explain why that occurred. And I think it's out of fear, going like, I don't want that to happen again. And it's like, well, I can't give you that promise. But I can give you the promise that there is somebody that will never leave you nor forsake you, that will be with you and is a very present source of help in every time of need. And that's good news.
Yeah.
I cannot speak for any other beating heart on the planet.
Nope.
But that guy Jesus is available, and you can know him. And that is where I start to lose my fear of. It's like, you know what, Lord? I think you're big enough for this. I'm not, but I think you are. Say help.
Yeah. Yeah, there's any hope for someone like Derek? I hear this question a lot from people when I travel around, feel like I've never had love, never had this, and how do I do it? And pretty much said similar things that you and I have said here in the last few minutes to people. And I'll come back a year or two later, and they're just going, wow, I can't believe what God's opened up in my heart. And so I know this is a battle God wins. That's not just some kind of throw it out there. It sometimes takes time for whatever needs to be reordered inside the life to be reordered so you can see what's already true. But and I just got an email from someone recently. They went through a whole dark valley for a bit of time, didn't feel loved by anybody, and wrote me, I guess, and I told them something about, you'll get this. One day it will become clear. Just keep knocking, keep coming, keep seeking, keep asking. Where it finally has happened for them. And they just, elated with, man, I never thought I would get to experience this. And so it does happen. Yeah, it just, it's not as easy as to say, here's the three steps to make that happen, or here's the three places to go. Look, God's more in control of this than that. So how he wants to make his love known to you is going to be very different than how he wants to make love known to someone else around you. Just know that he does, and keep opening your life to that and looking for love. Look around you and see, where does something happen? Where does someone treat me? Where, that might be what love is. And sometimes I think for people, particularly who have been abused or neglected, your hurt to what other people have done really shows you where love isn't. So now you know love is the opposite of that. Love is the other side of that. What does that look like? And I think even very painful bits in our life certainly make a difference in where we look for love, but it also changes the way we love other people. When I've been really, really hurt by somebody, part of my resolve is I don't want to ever treat somebody like that again for the rest of my life. I don't. And when that begins to connect with us in a real way, some wonderful stuff can happen, I think. So Nancy Jo said this. You got a little hit for your that we are the life we want or something. This was a long time ago, but we've had a lot.
In response to victimization?
I guess it wasn't even the Leroy podcast. It's the God Who Whispers. I was struck by Brad's thought in the God Who Whispers that was basically, we are who we want to be. I've never thought of myself as a victim, but I realized with Brad's line that I am not who I have wanted to be either. Through the various seasons of my life, I have had one or several conditions I felt obliged to accommodate. This resulted in a somewhat fatalistic stuck feeling that I'd hash out with God regarding what I would do about it. It was a breaking idea that I had chosen to be stuck by not choosing something other. And actually, when I was reading that, I think that's the point. I think other people misinterpreted it with, so I'm a mess, and I've chosen to be a mess and stuck in sin. And
yeah, that's what I was saying.
But I think what you were saying, and I think that's the better part of it, it's not, no, you chose to live this horrible life, but we all every day have a choice to keep going the way we're going or to stop a minute and turn around and say, God, I want to be something different.
Yeah, here's the deal. Even if I am a victim of someone else's wrongdoing and it has severely damaged me, I get that. I'm not saying you invited that, you're master of your destiny, and somehow you secretly wanted that. I mean, that's welcome to Satan 101, okay?
Okay.
But in terms
glad
of...
Glad to be here.
Yeah. In terms of...
Satan 101.
What I do then, you know what? In those moments, I can choose to remain in my hurt and my mess and wall myself off. And then it's like, gosh, I don't know how to help that. I really don't. Or I can, in the midst of that, know how to reach out and say, God, help. I'd like something different. And I do think it requires courage. That it's easy to wall off. That you slap me, I'm going to withdraw my hand. I'm going to go, don't do that again.
Yeah.
I think it's really hard in those moments of pain to reach out and make an active choice. And that's where it's like, I want to empower people. You're still at every juncture, still left with the capacity to choose to ask for help. You may not have any of your own resources to do much of anything with what's going on, but you're not so powerless you can't cry out for help.
So Chris takes it further in his flight of fancy. So when Paul said he did what he wanted to do and didn't do what he wanted to do in Romans 7, Brad's answer would be, no, you're doing exactly what you want to do.
Oh, yeah, that's exactly
how you would interpret Roman 7?
Uh-huh.
Interesting.
Hey, Chris, I didn't know I thought that.
I guess he doesn't buy the whole it's no longer I who sins, but sin who indwells me thing either. Kind of steals the thunder of hope in the rest of the chapter on into chapter 8.
Yep, I am the stealer of hope.
Also, I wonder when Brad accidentally touches something hot like a burner, how much volition or choice does it take for him to pull his hand away?
I just said I do.
Does he just react to the pain, or does he have to sit and make a conscious decision to move his hand away? Maybe I'm wired differently. Maybe he's wired differently than me, but for me, it's a reaction, not a conscious decision.
Sin is a reaction?
He doesn't say what it is.
See, I mean, yeah, that's where I'll be honest. I'm a little confused by that because I think they're a little different.
Well, I think he misunderstood you clearly by what he said in the first part, that you would say to Paul, no, Paul, sorry, you are doing
Paul,
exactly what you want to do.
Here's the gospel of Brad.
I mean, you do think sin is at work in us to make us do what we wouldn't otherwise freely choose to do.
I'll go one further. I think we got supernatural evil that's hunting us.
Okay.
Okay? I do think we have an enemy.
I'll sleep better tonight.
Yeah, that's hope. The stealer of hope. I'll add some nightmares to that.
Next time I ask you a question, don't go one further.
No, see, I do think we have supernatural evil out there. It can find a place in me. But what I love about what Paul's talking about is the differentiation there is, guess what? There's stuff going on in my life that, no, I don't want to do, but guess what I'm doing? And he's saying, there's something that's in me. The good news is Jesus can deal with that.
And it's not me doing it. I don't take my identity off my failures.
No.
And I think that's what Chris is suggesting, maybe. And I think that's what other people feel, is, oh, I am my failures. And I go, no, you're not.
But there is that place I see in what Paul is saying is he is acknowledging. He's not just excusing. Well, no, it's not my fault. He's saying there's something there. He's acknowledging the reality of the conflicted heart.
Yeah.
Okay. He's saying there's stuff I want to do and stuff I don't want to do, and gosh, I'm a mess. Good news, who's going to deliver me out of that?
Yeah, and
Jesus.
I'm not big enough to fix it. That's what he's saying.
And to me, the idea of being a victim is when you stay in that excusivism and you're just going like, well, it's not my fault, I didn't do it, and I'm not opening up, that isn't seeming to be the place that says, hey, help, deliver me. I'm not looking to blame people for what's going on. Like, well, no, you really did. But I do think that, look, sin doesn't force you to do itself. I don't think Paul is saying that I'm not associated with this, or I didn't have a chooser that agreed for a moment, because I do think we're culpable. I mean, someone else wrote and said, oh, I'm terrified of, you know, every thought word. It's like, well, guess what? I don't think you need to be terrified, but yeah, we are culpable. I think that's part of repent. I think that's part of taking ownership. And I don't want to wipe that away.
Yeah, but I think people interpret that with a greater personal blame than you would ascribe to it, but it would still sound like you're affirming it to them.
Really?
Yeah. I mean,
okay.
I would say, I think when Paul says, hey, when I do the very thing I don't wish to do, I realize that's no longer me, but sin that indwells me. So
yeah.
I'm not owning it in the sense that that's me and that's what I really want. That's not me. That's not what I really want. That's where this soul is captive to some brokenness. But I don't think he's just excusing it by saying, so I'm sinking deep in sin. Wee! Just I'm going to go for it.
And that's where go ahead.
No, but he does go back to then, who can set me free? I can't. Only he can. And that Romans 5, Paul talking about being helpless in sin. I love that understanding because I think most people feel helpless in sin. And even if they don't, I think what's scary is people saying, well, I don't do that sin and that sin and that sin, and don't recognize the religious arrogance and things that fill their life that's even worse, as Paul says, than adultery or immorality or some of those other things. So I really do think we're powerless against sin. Doesn't mean we don't have a volitional choice to bring that to Jesus and say, God, I want you to touch my life and work on this. But I do think it takes away from the fact that I need to be blamed or culpable in the sense of it's my fault because I chose it today. I don't know.
I don't know that I'm looking to ascribe blame.
Yep.
But I would say this. I mean, I've dealt with a ton of people who have sat there going like, I can't get free from this. And for people that have felt stuck and helpless in their sin, part of me has seen at times some very effective help by asking the question, you know what? Is there any part of you that is in agreement that kind of does want this? Let's just look at that. It's not trying to blame or shame.
Right.
It's just trying to say, you know what? In terms of that true heart's cry for deliverance, you say you don't want this, and I believe that, but you're still stuck here. See, because Paul got an answer from the God who said, who will deliver me? He didn't stay stuck where he is for the rest of the journey. And I'm going like, gosh, when someone is still stuck there, without shaming or blaming or making it worse, I do want to be able to ask the honest inquiry, gosh, is there anything about this that you do like? It's a little twisted, which is why you may be holding on to that. Let's look at that, because I believe there's an answer to help untwist that, because lurking underneath those things, the choices that I make, there's right ways that God would fill those needs, and there's wrong ways that we try to fill them for us. And I think when you can sort of an honest inquiry, just go like, gosh, I mean, I know this about most all the sin that I do. I kind of like it. That's not me trying to make someone feel awful, but it's like, well, I do feel a part. Like, I was choosing. I'm not an addict person that is in that place of powerlessness. So I'm not really wanting to speak to that person that's feeling, I'm owned by this. But I think there's a lot of...
But that's possible in your mind.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
That helps.
Okay.
I think people understand that. Because I do think we're part of this process. But I would even say, I'm not sure... Like, I was an angry guy for years, and I could manage it externally. And I thought that was what it meant to overcome it. I could manage it so that you wouldn't know it, and it would blow up somewhere else. But when God began to really unravel that part of me, and I don't know that I ever enjoyed my anger. It was a reaction to a lot of things going on in my life that God untangled. And it left me in a much better place of being free. But I look back at my life going, I'm not sure I could have fixed that earlier. It was a process of knowing Him and being transformed in Him. And that wasn't just I'm choosing to indulge some flesh somewhere. It was a reactive way that Wayne had gotten used to responding to adverse stimuli, if we want to say it that way. And God untangling that was just bigger. Even when I could avoid the external expression of that anger, it was still at work in a deeper level that was destroying other stuff and other people in my life. And so I do think there's a part of us that steps back and say, okay, I can't set myself free from that. I like what you're saying. Where am I cooperating with this? That's a good question to ask about anything. Where do I secretly love what's going on here and therefore am not aggressively carrying it to Jesus and therefore am staying a victim of something that I don't need to be a victim of anymore? I get that. I think there's just a whole lot of different applications of this that defy an easy explanation.
And I don't think I'm purporting to have the answer. Of all things, I know that for me.
But you're sure scared some people.
I guess. I think they ascribe too much power to my thoughts. I think on the whole anger thing, one of the things that completely undid this little angry young man is when I heard someone say, "You know, your anger shows who you serve." And I just kind of went, "He didn't give me a Bible verse on that." And I just went, "Oh, what are the implications if that's true?" Well, most of my anger was not righteous indignation on behalf of the holiness of God.
Even though I had labeled it such.
Yeah. You know, and you know, what I do with anger is, well, I don't call it anger. It's just, I'm frustrated. That's, you know, it's just, that's the inoculation of it. No, I don't have, so I'm just frustrated. Okay, well, whatever. I finally looked at it and went, even when I'm frustrated, the truth is there's the me and what I want that's not getting his way, and that's my frustration that is really, and I kind of went, you know what? I do believe that that is true. That's showing. So, gosh, Lord, I don't want to remain an angry young man. This thing feels like it owns me.
Yeah.
I would subscribe in my own experience. I didn't feel powerful to be able to just change that. Like, guess what? I've just decided.
And I think that's how people heard what you said earlier. So I think that really helps people understand that.
But I think what empowers God to gain ground in my life is when there's the humility of ownership of it that just says, gosh, Lord, unite my heart to fear your name. I got a divided heart. I want this and I want that, and I don't know what I want. I don't even know what's good for me. Lord, be Lord in that domain, mm-hmm. and bring me together in such a way that, you know, when your eye is single, your whole body is full of light.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know how to make my eye single, but I know that He can unite my heart. And it's like when I find myself stuck in an area, and I do want freedom, but at the same time, I know I really don't have it. That's where I start to then apply some of this stuff and saying, Lord, shine your light, search me, see if there be any wicked way in me. Help me understand and I'll own it. If I can't see it and I don't know how to own it, I don't know how to get free from it. So that is more the import of going, I found that to be very helpful in my life and for a lot of folks that I've tried to help walk out of places they're stuck.
Yeah, and I think part of the religious focus on sin creates in our spiritual journey sometimes this self-improvement focus that when God's going to talk to me today, it's definitely going to be about my sin and where I need to fix something or try harder. I think I would say, I don't know how you would wear this, I would, and statistics are crazy, but I would say 90% of my relationship with Jesus is about enjoying Him, seeing things new in Him, watching how He's caring for my life. And about 10% is focused on fixing something. And I mean, that comes from Him. I think mostly for me, it's like, I want this fixed, that fixed, that fixed. I think coming from Him, what He knows is the relationship of growing love and trust will displace the sin. As Paul says, walk by the Spirit and you won't carry out the desires of the flesh. I think too many believers begin with, I'm not going to carry out the desires of the flesh. So then I can walk by the Spirit.
Yeah, don't think of a green elephant.
Well, somebody sent me this about golf, and I thought, and he was actually making the application beyond golf into spiritual life, but I thought it was really true. I love playing golf. He said, the culture of golfers causes people to see golf through a filter that says something is always wrong. It's based on a belief that says something is wrong and needs to be fixed. It's based on a belief that somewhere there's a formula for success that golfers must continually struggle to find. But there is no freedom in a formula. There's no satisfaction in feeling something is wrong all the time. And I do think the whole misunderstanding, the whole preoccupation, maybe we'll say, of the flesh and sin, often in religious environments, really takes us away from letting the relationship grow in a way that's healthy, alive, and vital.
It keeps you stuck there at times.
Yeah.
It really does. It doesn't. There's nothing positive that's displacing it.
And if you don't have that, I think you're just stuck in the war against sin. I really think it's not about waking up today and God wants me to battle sin so at the end of the day I could be a better person for Him. I think that's what religion wants us to do. And when it talks about be holy as I am holy, it's really talking about a performance plateau instead of I want to be like Him. I want to think how He thinks. I want to love the way He loves. And if I don't get to live inside that discovery for a season, I'm not going to be able to just get up and fix my life and try to be more sinless and be like that golfer. We had a golfer guy we used to joke about all the time because every time we were on the golf course, we hit a new club. Hit the latest thing for this or that. And I just wanted to be downstream of his rejected golf wear. You don't want that club? Let me try it now. And it was just because there's something that will fix this game. And you know what? Those people don't enjoy the game of golf. They can hit 100.
Yeah, I've golfed with too many of them.
They can hit 50 good shots in a round, then they shank one into the woods and I blew my perfect
anger player. Monster comes out.
Oh man, when you live with that, it just don't play golf. Golf is just about on its worst day, it's a walk in the park with some good friends. And I think the journey in Jesus, if it's so sin focused, need focused, it's just gonna wear us out. And then this from Jason. I want to know what you thought about this because I didn't sync with his point. He said, I've heard it taught, and it makes sense, that when Jesus took upon himself the sin of the world and became sin, absolutely, and there's a lot of caps here, all 100% of the Father's wrath, anger, and judgment was poured out upon Jesus once and for all. That being said, it means that Jesus bore the judgment, wrath, and anger for sin, past, present, and future, and appeased God's righteous anger once and for all. Therefore, there are believers who say that when a person suffers or a nation suffers, as in the whole earthquake thing we talked about a couple weeks ago, it is God's judgment. But my question is, why does God punish or judge a people or a nation when his judgment already fell on Jesus? And I read this, and I
kind of struggle with the whole appeasement thing right there.
The whole thing uses language that I think comes from a really religious base. It's even got the angry God judging, punishing, tormenting his son. So now he's not doing it anywhere else on the planet anymore. I don't think he ever was. I don't think God's judgment is I'm punishing people because of my anger. And I think that's what we've often heard that it is. So an earthquake or an act of God, a flood, a hillside.
Yeah, every disaster is an act of God, the angry God. You know what? I think those are more the acts of Satan. I think there's supernatural evil that does some of that stuff.
Yeah, we heard about that earlier.
Yeah, that's going one step further. Satan. No, but I think there's the whole planet has been subjected to futility because of the breaking of sin and its entrance. And it has not been fully restored. We're not, yeah. I mean, last time I checked, we're somewhere in the book of Revelation, but we're not at the end.
Well, I think the tragedies of the world, can they be devil-inspired? Yeah. Can they just be that a world is out of sync with the Creator?
Yes.
So, yeah, I think that can also be true. But to see that Jesus, and this put Jesus on the cross to be the victim of all God's anger and punishment. So now God doesn't do that anymore. One, I'm going, okay, you can't look at Revelation and say God's done judging. And I don't mean judging and I've got to punish the people because I'm angry. I think judgment, as we've talked about before, is to make right that which is wrong and twisted. And God's judgment certainly...
That's not necessarily bad. I think that's good.
There's nothing bad about that. I think that's amazing. I think I pray for God's judgment every day. I hope he's not done judging, because if this is heaven, it's, I tell you, it's not what I hoped it would be. There are moments with my granddaughters and my wife and friends that, yeah, it seems like heaven on earth. But overall, gosh, there's too much pain, hurt, and brokenness. God's judgment is not done. And I would take exception to the fact that this wrath and anger was all what the cross was about. It's God was curing in himself the sin of the race. And God's wrath is God's love. It's not this unrequited anger that just had to beat something up to feel better about itself.
Where? I know in a lot of other religions with other gods where the whole appeasement thing comes from.
Yep.
Where does the appeasement mindset come from? Maybe I've just forgotten those scriptures, but I've really forgotten what scriptures are talking about God's anger needing to be appeased. I'm at a loss there.
Well, there's a lot of Old Testament language about seeing God as an angry deity?
No, but I'm talking the concept of appeasement. He's angry. I must do this to and satisfy his anger.
I don't think the scriptures are there. I do think people see that in the offerings and sacrifices that God, blood, you know, requires a salvation requires a blood sacrifice. So there's this bloodthirsty God that's got to be appeased by the death of stuff.
See, I think,
and then finally his son was the ultimate sacrifice. That's how most people see it.
Yeah, and I think, unfortunately, that's not really understanding what Jesus did on the cross or even the fact of the analogy of the Old Testament sacrifices. Yeah, I mean, when you look at the Old Testament sacrifices, it isn't this, "I'm going to rip the head of the goat off." I mean...
Wow. Poor goat.
No, I mean, you have the whole scapegoat, and you have this other stuff where it's like, there's something about the innocence and the laying down of its life that if it's all about of appeasement, you don't see the volitional act of the lamb. Jesus says, No man takes my life.
Yeah.
I am laying it down. And you're just like, wait a minute. Appeasement would say, well, sorry, it's just a penalty. Someone's got to enact it. Well, if he says no man's taking it,
maybe God is.
See, no, but see, that's where I'm going. Like, I think the way they viewed all of this, the whole Old Testament, the sacrifice, those people were not there in the bloodthirsty cowering. Oh, okay, I got to give up the farm animals. I think they understood it very differently than it is being portrayed in that kind of language.
Well, yeah, if you still got this God who's this unrequited, wrathful, angry, judgment as punishment kind of thing, deity, and he just exhausted it all on Jesus, so now we're all done. I'm going, boy, that violates the story in so many ways. Because then you're just really, I mean, that God is still a bit of a creep. You know, you just man, I finally got my whacking in. As long as I got to whack something, I'm good now. I'm thinking, that's not a father I want to know. And as I said, if the judgment's all done, it's just such a negative view of judgment I don't hold anymore. I want God's judgment in the earth. I don't see it in every earthquake, landslide, wildfire. I don't. I see God's judgment as God at work in creation to set right what sin has twisted and destroyed. And there comes a day, Revelation, there's a lot of Revelation to me, like you, still future. I don't think all that was fulfilled back at the temple. So I'm going, there's a day coming when God's going to make a new heaven and a new earth. Then there'll be no need for judgment in the sense of all has been made as it was intended to be.
When a homeless guy flicks a cigarette butt and it starts a forest fire, and when you look at what's going on in Texas and all of those, they actually have traced it to a homeless man in his little camp. And you go like, is that the axe of God? Did God whip that up? Or is that the careless axe of a man that have had the horrible consequence? Well, I don't know that you're just going to repent and somehow, oh, this is God. I think when people have that one-to-one construct without God's voice declaring that, you end up with a whole bunch of funky stuff that I don't think is true. And I look at the whole Old Testament and the sacrificial system. There's a lot of wonderful offerings that were celebratory participations. A lot of the Old Testament sacrifices, you might see them more like a shared barbecue. I mean, when the priest actually consumes and eats some of
it. You're the Levite's barbecue.
But no, I mean, think about that. It's not, I mean, I was over in Israel and they said, the place just always smells like a barbecue. And you're just going, what?
I like that smell.
They had a sense of, wait a minute, there's something of a participation in this. This is not just appeasement, wrath stuff. And I don't understand where that filtered in, that's the one lens through which we see all this.
Yeah, and that's the lens I think religion has definitely given us. The angry God needing to be appeased, and now we're okay because he got it all worked out somehow. But then the love folks, the love crowd, has taken it on to mean all sins, past, present, future, have already been resolved in Christ for every human being on the planet. And you just look around the planet going, I don't think so. I don't think that's all been resolved yet. There's no wrath left for those of us who know Christ and have come through his blood and life, and that love has redeemed us as well as it destroyed sin in him. I get that that's true in my life, but in the world we live in, there's much judgment still needed, but that's, as I said, not something I fear. Man, I pray for that every day and embrace it in my own life and in the world. Come judge. Make right what the world has obviously destroyed.
Traveling with us on the God Journey. You can be part of the conversation by visiting our website, thegodjourney.com.